The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading selections from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. This is the final episode of April. We will dig a little deeper into the April issue of Our State Magazine, the theme of which features articles all about North Carolina's revolutionary heritage. Our first article comes from the regular column entitled Hidden History. It's uncovering forgotten artifacts and delving into dusty archives to explore the little-known stories of our state. And this article is entitled Cloaked in Meaning. In Iredell County, Fort Dobbs State Historic Site provides a window into pre-Revolutionary War life at the edge of North Carolina's western frontier. A few miles outside Statesville, a curling ribbon of road unfurls across a wide grassy field. Here, a spot-on replica of a frontier fort perches on a small rise. The fort looks like a large wooden block, its sides freckled with 300 gun ports. The flanks of its dovetailed timbers bear the marks of broadaxe and adze, their rough-hewn surfaces rippling like fish scales. Fort Dobbs State Historic Site tells the story of North Carolina's role in the French and Indian War, a conflict that decided who would control the eastern part of North America. It's a history often overshadowed by the Revolutionary War that followed little more than a decade later, out of which a new nation was born and our great experiment, in quotes, in democracy began. To enter this faithful recreation of a building constructed in this exact spot 270 years ago is to step back in time, a time when clothing consisted of petticoats and caps with lappets, shifts and stays, knee breeches and wrapping gowns, a time when you could have been a cordwainer, a chandler, or a fellmonger, when kitchens would have held trammels and trenchers and long peels. When we lead guided tours, almost all of the time it's done by someone in authentic clothing, says Scott Douglas, the former site manager at Fort Dobbs. It kind of helps you immerse into the environment itself and facilitates that time travel for visitors a little bit. Today, Douglas wears hemp trousers, a linen shirt, a waistcoat and jacket, a wide-brimmed felt hat, and a handkerchief wrapped around his neck. Around him, more than a dozen volunteers wear similar period clothing, most of which they researched and made themselves. The occasion is Historic Trades Day, a recurring event that allows Fort Dobbs staff to take visitors back in time to the province of North Carolina, circa 1750s. Across the fort grounds, these reenactors demonstrate the trades that were vital at that time. Here, a brickmaker uses a wooden form to mold bricks, setting them aside to bake in the sun. There, under a three-sided shed, a blacksmith labors over an anvil, hammering glowing iron into hardware. By an open fire, a chandler dips wicks into hot tallow and beeswax before hanging them to dry. Inside the fort, cordwainers fashion leather footwear with silver buckles. And everywhere you look, the accoutrements of an 18th century fort jump out at you. Crockery and cookware piled on wooden shelves. Uniform jackets, haversacks, and waistcoats hang from wooden pegs. Muskets leaning against walls. A storeroom brimming with barrels of flour, rice, and dried peas. Barracks stacked with soldiers' bunks. What you won't see are signs saying, "Don't touch." Instead, you're encouraged to climb into a soldier's bed, the ticking mattress lofted with straw for the enlisted men, feathers for the officers, and try on an officer's heavy wool jacket. Our visitors can interact with everything in the fort, Douglas says. It's not a house museum where everything is behind a rope. It's a big classroom, and it's literally a way for people to get their hands on everything. The original Fort Dobbs was completed in 1756 as part of the British colonial defenses against raids by the Shawnee, allies of the French in what would also become known as the Seven Years' War. The fort protected the Fourth Creek settlement, named for the tributary that flows into South Yadkin River. The community of about 35 homesteads, a Presbyterian church, a store, and a tavern was a vanguard, the very edge of the western frontier. At the beginning of the French and Indian War, the British and Cherokee were on the same side, trading with one another, sharing resources, and fighting a common enemy. On Historic Trades Day, former site manager Jason Melius is dressed as a middle-class businessman of the time, someone who would have had a license to trade with the Cherokee. Attired for hot weather, he wears a linen cap, shirt, and neckcloth over a dressing gown, checked trousers, and handmade leather shoes with brass buckles. The Cherokee were incredibly tight allies, he says. They're tied economically at the hip with the colonies. The Shawnees were their ancient enemies, so that makes for a natural alliance. But it was not to last. A series of murders of Cherokee people, first led by Virginia colonists and then by South Carolinians, frayed the alliance and ignited the Anglo-Cherokee War, essentially a second conflict within the French and Indian War. Only one skirmish associated with this war took place at Fort Dobbs. A group of Cherokee people attacked the fort on the night of February 27, 1760, and were repelled by troops commanded by Lieutenant Hugh Waddell. Unfortunately, the long-term consequences of the war were far more devastating for the Cherokee. The commanders of the two British armies sent on campaigns against the Cherokee knew the Cherokee weren't responsible for starting the conflict. They wanted them back as allies and understood the best way to do that was to minimize the impact of the war. But things did not turn out that way. In 1760, they burned 10 Cherokee towns and all the associated food, Melius says. In 1761, they burned as many as 18 towns, and in that one campaign, they destroyed the homes and food of 5,000 men, women, and children. When the Cherokee signed a treaty to end the conflict in December of 1761, they ceded vast tracts of land. The new line of demarcation between British colonial and Cherokee lands moved farther west, and by 1764, the frontier had moved some 70 miles, close to present-day Morganton, making Fort Dobbs obsolete. The fort was abandoned. As the only North Carolina state historic site devoted to the French and Indian War, Fort Dobbs plays an important role in illuminating the lesser-known conflicts that live in the shadow of the American Revolution. But even more important, it showcased what life was like on North Carolina's colonial frontier, from the clothing to comestibles and beyond. In a big way, it's a window into the larger story of the settlement of Western North Carolina, Melia says. If you were to take a tour of the fort on a regular Tuesday through Saturday, a lot of the focus is the daily lives of the people, the soldiers, the civilians in the area, the native people who interacted with the fort in hostile and friendly ways. In fact, prior to the Anglo-Cherokee conflict, this was a place that was more about cooperation than conflict. Fort Dobbs showcases the kind of interconnectedness of this world economy, Melius says. Yet as remote as this tiny community was, it had a place in global commerce. At the time, deerskins were in high demand in Europe. The Cherokee hunted and traded deerskins in great volume. 95% of deer hides came from native hands, Melius says. In 1765, Charleston exported 100,000 deer hides. In return, the Cherokee would have received items from across the globe, block-printed handkerchiefs from India, silk from China, linen and wool from England, rum from Jamaica, spices from the East Indies, plus beads and ribbons, silver and tobacco, powdered pigments, knives, axes, musket balls, and gunpowder. It was a veritable Walmart of the 1750s frontier, a world not so nearly isolated as it would seem. That global connection is further highlighted by one of Melius's favorite artifacts. There were peach pits found in the cellar of the fort, he says, referencing to one of the several archaeological digs that have taken place at the site. Peaches are from China, and there are peach orchards all over North Carolina by the early 1700s because the Spanish had brought them in the 1500s, and the native people spread them because they ended up loving them too. It's kind of a neat connection. For Melius, the peach pits connect us to our ancestors in a poignant way. To me, that's the most human connection I can make with those guys who served here. You can kind of picture soldiers sitting out there on a hot summer day eating peaches. And that is something any of us can sit out there and do to share that same experience. So we may never don a petticoat or knee breeches in our everyday lives. We may never walk a mile in our ancestors' handmade shoes, but we can still enjoy a ripe, juicy peach. And in so doing, we can get a taste of life on the North Carolina frontier. For more information about the Fort Dobbs State Historic Site, check out their website at fortdobbs.org. And their address is 438 Fort Dobbs Road, Statesville, North Carolina. Next up, we'll turn to another regular column called Streets with a Story. Discover the roads where North Carolina's past and present converge. And this one is about Elizabethtown and Broad Street in particular. It's lunchtime in Elizabethtown, and on Broad Street, store owners, workers, and shoppers are stepping outside and heading down to Melvin's Hamburgers and Hot Dogs for a sack to go. At Melvin's, a staple in town since 1938, the line runs out the back door as hot dogs are loaded onto buns and topped, quote, all the way, mustard, chili, onions, and slaw, then wrapped and dropped into brown paper bags to be carried off to their destinations. Outside of Melvin's and all along Broad Street, American flags mounted to light poles wave in the wind beside banners celebrating Elizabethtown's 250th anniversary in 2023. This symbol of freedom might not have been here if it weren't for the Battle of Elizabethtown. The conflict, which took place along this street in 1781, was one of the most significant Revolutionary War battles in the Cape Fear region. On the early morning of August 27th, musket fire rang out as Whig troops launched a surprise attack against a Tory encampment. Using intelligence gathered by Patriot spy Sally Salter, who had entered the Tory camp the day before under the pretense of selling eggs, the Patriots shouted fake commands to non-existent soldiers. This made their numbers, only about 60 or 70 men, appear larger than they really were. Fearing the defeat, the Loyalists, some 300 to 400 men, ran for their lives, many jumping into a deep ravine near the Cape Fear River, which to this day is known as Tory Hole. It is this retreat that has led some to mistakenly call this event the Battle of Tory Hole. Amateur local historian Lewis D. Smith wants to end the confusion once and for all. He often sports a ball cap that reads, "It was the Battle of Elizabethtown, not the Battle of Tory Hole." Smith is passionate about the battle and about Elizabethtown history in general. He has an extensive collection of photos, including one of Broad Street in 1911 that shows a dirt road with just a few houses on it. Smith listened to conversations between his father, Lloyd Ernest Smith, and other locals when they talked about people and places around Elizabethtown. Smith's family roots go back more than 150 years here. In 1895, his grandfather, Daniel Lloyd Smith, built a house on Broad Street for his bride-to-be, who wouldn't marry him until he added a porch, so she could get from the kitchen to the house without getting wet when it rained. Daniel operated a dry goods store, and Smith's grandmother, Margaret Eva Smith, opened a boarding house and a hat store here. Today, Smith lives on Broad Street in their former home, though he has never married. When asked why he's never tied the knot, the 83-year-old says, "I ain't old enough yet." So what to do and see if you're in Elizabethtown? There's Lane Wands of Elizabethtown. It's in operation since 1935. This shop is one of the oldest businesses in Bladen County. Four generations of Lane Wands, including Ricky and his son Michael, have worked in the specialty department store, which sells men's, women's, and children's name brand clothing, shoes, and accessories, and more. They have a website, lanewands.com, that's spelled or line wands, L-E-I-N, like November, W-A-N, November, D like David, S like Sam.com, linewands.com. Then there's Bladen Office Supplies. In 1986, Walter Bullard purchased the former Rowe Cinema, built in 1947, and converted the building into an office supply store. Today, the front of the store features photos from the building's theater days. Bullard and Smith both reminisce about seeing double features, westerns with live shows before the movies, for just 15 cents. Your parents gave you a dollar and you could come to the movie, buy your popcorn and drink, and still have money left over, Bullard says. My parents gave me a quarter, Smith says. I could get a movie and a popcorn and two packs of BBs, which are sold at the dime store. Then there's Kinlaw Furniture. Open since 1938, Kinlaw Furniture offers bedroom, living room, and dining room sets, as well as appliances. The store has expanded over the years to encompass three buildings, one of which was once the Ben Franklin 5 and 10. Michael Sasser, who owns the business, and his wife Ann ran the popcorn machine in the old 5 and dime when he was 14, selling the buttery snack for 25 cents a box on Saturdays. And then, of course, there's Melvin's Hamburgers and Hot Dogs. Melvin's no longer features pool tables like it did when it opened in 1938, but the burgers are as good as ever. Quality beef smashed on the flat top, topped simply with chili, mustard, onions, and slaw, with optional hot sauce, ketchup, and cheese. The No Frills restaurant churns out thousands of hamburgers and hot dogs a day to folks who travel from down the street or across time zones just for a bite of the best darn burger around. Since warmer weather is upon us, we will switch gears a little bit and move away from the Revolutionary War to an article entitled Beach Bunnies. At a Riceville Beach Resort, a most unexpected resident frolics through sandy dunes and secret gardens. Dawn's thin line traces the horizon, giving faint shape to the twin swells of dune and sand, of wave and dune, separating the night sky from the waking world of Riceville Beach. The gardens at Trailbourne Surf and Sound stay dark. Shapes here are shrubs, stones, and shadows. Pink light stains each wave crest and spike of sea oat crowning the dunes. Once it reaches the uppermost boughs of a pine, the first bird of the morning starts its song. Two pleasant notes and a car alarm trill set on repeat. The grass glitters with dew, marred only by a single line of tracks stretching from a copse of landscaping into the wide open lawn. At the end of those tracks, a lone rabbit sniffs the air before bowing its head for a nibble. As the sun climbs, surfers claim the first waves of today's, quote, dawn patrol, and the growing light reveals more rabbits on Trailbourne's lawn. On ocean-facing balconies, grown-ups wrapped in robes and kids in pajamas peer over and through the rail at the scene below. The lone rabbit has now become three more. No, four. Five more. Six. There, a stone in the landscape has sprouted ears, stretched its rocky head forward, and taken a hop. Marsh rabbits reside in marshy wetlands and live in the landscaping of Riceville Beach and Middle Island. And there are a lot of them, some 200 to 300. Some call them blue tails for the blue-gray fur on their bellies and rumps. In other places, people call them cane cutters for their habit of eating switch cane. In addition to roots, bulbs, tubers, woody stems, flowers, berries, and just about any other foliage or fruit they can work between their teeth. The marshes offer plenty of food, but gardens are a buffet. They absolutely love people with grassy yards and a well-kept garden, says Shannon Slocum, park ranger for the town of Riceville Beach. And if they like what you've planted, they can be quite destructive. Landscaping at Trailbourne Surf and Sound surprises first-time visitors. The last thing they expect at the beach is a lush lawn and a garden bursting with blooms. Still, there it is, hidden behind a seven-story hotel on one side, a wall of dune and grasses on the other. I've had folks call it an oasis or even compare it to the Garden of Eden, says William, known as Pepper, the groundskeeper for Trailbourne and its predecessor, the Blockade Runner Beach Resort. But it's taken time to get this landscaping as, quote, rabbit-proof as it is now. It's got to be rabbit-proof, or reasonably so. This is a gathering spot for trailborn guests and the crown jewel of one of the only surf-to-sound resorts on the East Coast. Barefoot kids play here. At the hotel's Italy Meets Carolina restaurant, La Duna Paradiso, you can dine al fresco, sitting in a sea of native and tropical plants. At night, adults sip cocktails by the fire pit. Teens retreat to far corners away from their families, and the rabbits browse the verge for dinner. Pepper's plantings are thoughtful, carefully planned to send the rabbits elsewhere for a bite. Ornamental plants like cabbage and kale look lovely in the cold, cool weather pots and plots, but the rabbits chew these tasty morsels right to the ground. Showy flowers like zinnias, cosmos, morning glory vines, and snapdragons rarely get to bloom thanks to these fuzzy hopping mowers. Flowering and fruiting shrubs like quince and rose are as delicious to the rabbits as they are beautiful to us. So what don't they eat? Well, they don't like lantana. They won't touch it. Or lilies, Pepper says. Alliums, marigolds, and geraniums must not sit well with them either. Oh, he adds, they don't eat the prickly pear cactus or anything with thorns or stickers. Guess they prefer an easier bite to eat. The rabbits make a little extra work for the groundskeeping staff, he acknowledges, but they absolutely delight our guests. Kids and adults are surprised seeing them. Meaning a rabbit at a beach resort? Who expects rabbits at the beach? They're not just here in Trailborn's Secret Garden, but also across Waynick Boulevard at Soundside, where guests launch stand-up paddleboards and one-man sailboats into Banks Channel. They can swim, you know, Pepper says. Slocum's seen and heard of rabbits going for a swim, too. It's weird. You don't expect to see a rabbit in the water, but there they are, swimming in Banks Channel, in the town's retention pond, or at the edge of the marsh. In fact, marsh rabbits are skilled swimmers. Less fur and longer nails on their hind legs, plus smaller, more streamlined ears, make them more suited to coastal environments than their cottontail cousins. To escape predators, forage for aquatic plants, or simply navigate their watery world, they'll wade out only with their ears, eyes, and nose as visible. Slocum thinks of himself and his fellow rangers as ambassadors for Wrightsville Beach. Year-round, they patrol the shore in their jeeps and ATVs, reminding visitors there's no grass on the beach and answering questions like, "Did I really see a rabbit earlier today?" In his 25 years with Wrightsville Beach, Slocum's responded to all sorts of wildlife calls. Corn snakes on the beach, a raccoon or opossum attracted to an oyster roast, once a black bear in the business district, but not one related to rabbits. Instead, he fields questions about them from curious visitors, new residents, and even Wrightsville natives. Maybe they're the best ambassadors, he said. They're certainly a memorable part of visiting our part of the coast. Can you imagine going home and saying to your friends, "You won't believe what I saw at Wrightsville Beach"? Marsh rabbits don't travel in skipping cartoon bounds, four paws held high and tight to the chest if it's clutching some candy-laden basket, or in a brash Bugs Bunny stroll. They move more like herbivorous cats. They slink with sly steps, creeping one foot at a time to the next bit of tasty greenery, or with short, confident bounds, or in an all-out sprint, ears streamlined against the skull, muscled haunches pistoning. When it's morning proper and the temperature hangs between beach breeze, pleasant, and humid summer day, the rabbits come alive. Heavy-bodied adults browse the verge for the best morsels. Sleek-furred juveniles keep themselves busy with play. Three race around the fire pit in a game of duck-duck-goose. Some leap through the sprinkler's spray, their passage splitting the mist into a cloud of miniature rainbows. The youngest watch from the protective shade of a lawn-sized Connect Four. The high, sweet timbre of a young girl's voice freezes the fluffle of rabbits. A swim and a too-big cover-up, eyes hidden behind oversized glasses, the color of an electrified blueberry, she clutches her grandfather's hand and tows him past the pool, onto the boardwalk to the beach. "Come on, it's beach time," she says with her sing-song voice. "Beach time, beach time." She's full of excitement and the possibility of a pancake breakfast in her future, happily plunging into the second verse of her beach song when she spots the rabbit in the garden and stops in her track. Her grandfather nearly bowls her over. Moving from one bloom to bloom with delicate hops, the rabbit inches closer to the boardwalk. The girl prances in place, unable to contain her excitement. Her grandfather squats beside her, whispering something, no doubt, "Be still, be quiet, and we'll watch the bunny." Her song tapers off. The rabbit approaches. She freezes. Taking her quiet as a sign of safety, the rabbit makes a furtive hap-hop onto the boardwalk. Its little paws scratch against the wooden planks as it turns to the beach, the lawn, the girl, and moves. It hops toward her, and she backs up. It sniffs the air, makes another hop, but then she squeals, and the rabbit is off like a shot, streaking across a corner of the grass and disappearing once again into a tunnel in the shrubbery. Trailborn Surf and Sound is located at 275 Waynick Boulevard in Wrightsville Beach, North Carolina, and they have a website. It's trailborn.com/surf-sound. Our last one is a love note to North Carolina, and this is a new column with the magazine. It's a tiny tribute to the things we adore about where we call home. This is about Cafe Dryad. Midway up the hill that gives Chapel Hill half of its name is a coffee shop, Cafe Dryad. Like most beautiful things, you can't quite see it from the road. It's hidden beneath a hovering overhang of willow oak, crepe myrtle, elm, and pine, built on the edge of a hollow. Most of the seating is outdoors. From certain angles, you can look out into the woods below and believe that you're in a treehouse that also happens to make the best coffee in the world. Lives are changed here. Case in point, more than a quarter century ago, I met my wife at Cafe Dryad. I walk there at least 3 times a week, 2 miles there and 2 miles back. I take the same route through my neighborhood, past the library, to the greenway, and then up the steep hidden path, and I order the same drink every time, a matcha latte, hot in winter, iced in summer. I'm on my way there now. With the few seconds we have left, we'll add another quiz question to the mix here. Blackbeard may have carefully cultivated an image of fearsomeness as he sailed along our coast. According to legend, what did he tie in his beard and set alight before fights to scare his adversaries? Was it candles, matches, or cigars? If you said matches, you would be correct. Steed Bonnet's areas of piracy included the region near Cape Fear River in Southport. Before taking to the seas, Bonnet was a wealthy landowner in his native Barbados, earning him what alias name? The Gentleman Pirate, Prince Bonnet, or Silver and Gold Steed? It's the Gentleman Pirate. We've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it, and will join us next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.